problem, doesn't seem to me, to will have grown any. They're still going to have to borrow money. That's the purpose of some of these funds, being able to move money back and forth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with the bank broke, so they won't be able to borrow the money to finish out with.
No, they can't borrow from the banks. They're broke. Insurance is broke. Let's see. Workers' comp. We don't want them. We don't want them in that fund. Well, maybe we're back to the barbers and hairdressers.
You won't, Mr. Chairman, you won't have them. They'll be off using their money in the health division.
See what a mistake you made when, in that reorganization, you forgot about money. Okay. I think the analyst has sort of said what we're going to have to do. Unless there's, under the current law, there is a different way in which it would be administered that you could tell me about that would justify.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Weeks' recommendation is very workable. The only drawback is that we have to pay interest on the money, so it's, you know, it would be nice to, we would still have to borrow. We have to borrow a little bit more with his recommendation. But it's a workable recommendation.
Who's going to loan you the money?
You can have loans from the state treasurer, or if this bill goes through and we can borrow money from one of the other operating units, and then.
The last time we talked about it when we were in financial institutions, we didn't think the treasurer thought it was a good enough risk. Could get money out of them, so. But maybe it's changed now. Okay. Go ahead, then.
Speaking about revenue adjustments, we're showing that there's no change in the workers' compensation assessment projected due to the development of this new department. Now, if there's other pieces of legislation out there that would affect their rates, that's another issue from this. We're showing the fee increase for the insurance division would raise about $2.6 million, and that there's no fee increase scheduled for financial institutions at this time. The task force on that financial institutions division had recommended a fee increase, but we're trying to operate it without that fee increase.
Okay.
If you'd like to turn to tab B, it goes through the different units within this new department. And we talked about that there would be seven new positions created for the office of the director. In addition to that, there's two positions that would be transferred in from the workers' comp director's office to make a total of nine positions and $1.1 million. And the two positions that would be transferred in are the medical director and an assistant to that position. And these, the medical workers' comp medical director currently provides policy input and advice to mm-hmm. the director of workers' comp, and that role would shift to the director of the new department, so we move that position.
Would the department director share that information with the workers' comp director?
Oh, I'm sure so.
Okay. Hope so.
The workers' comp board is the next unit listed there, and that's a $10 million budget, and this is what was in the governor's printed budget, and there's no change to it, and I believe that budget's been heard by another subcommittee, and so they may have made an adjustment to that.
Well, another subcommittee is working on it. This subcommittee should be aware of that. The number that they come up with for an expenditure limitation in the other subcommittee is the number that this subcommittee would put in this bill when we get to limitations, is my understanding of how that will work. So we won't have to do the budget detail on the workers' comp board and leave that to Senator Trost's committee. He'll have a number. We'll put it in here.
That was my understanding.
Yeah.
On the next page, page two, you can see that the workers' compensation division budget would be $13 million, and that's the governor's printed budget for the workers' compensation department, less the units that have transferred out, and that's accident prevention division, administration and support division, and their personnel management. We've taken those units out of there.
Mm-hmm.
and the next couple pages list the decision units within workers' comp, which the other committee will look at. Mm-hmm. The accident prevention division, that's a $12 million budget, and that's shown on page 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And administration and support. On page 6, you get to the...
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Really, two positions. $10 million for support.
That's the governor's recommended budget and a position authority for the administration and support services division. That's currently within the workers' comp department, and there's no change to that made in this new department. It just takes on a division level rather than a program within another division. It'll provide support to the other programs.
Okay. It seems like a pretty large. Oh, well.
They have a...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
I don't understand. It would appear that with some of the consolidations, as Mr. Long has presented to us, and if they're going to consolidate the use in other activities like the auditors, where they're going to consolidate those functions, it would appear that under administrative support, that some of that would be able to be reduced somewhat. I'm sure that not the entire level is going to be retained as was previously used, because you're going to streamline some of your functions. I can't reconcile why we're consolidating this activity, the purpose supposedly of cost savings, and then not being able to show substantial administrative reduction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there are some savings. We left this administration support division's budget as it is, but where the savings are is we're taking out a data processing person and two business managers from, and a program exec from the insurance and financial institutions division's budget, because they won't have their own positions to do these anymore. They will take advantage of this larger unit that's already there. And also in the Department of Commerce, a position such as myself, that position is gone, because this budget coordination and overview will be performed by this larger division. So there are savings, but you don't see it in that dollar amount. When we get to the insurance budget, you can see some reductions there.
But there's not going to be any savings in administration and support.
They will have
the workers' compensation portion.
No, sir. They will have the same number of positions, but they will have more people they serve. Now it's not just workers' comp, but it's also financial institutions and insurance units.
We're going to have to analyze this pretty closely, because this support division comes from workers' comp department, CUNC.
Yeah.
It's paid for with workers' comp assessments, right?
Well, there would be... No.
I mean, it is now.
It is now.
Okay.
That's correct.
So then you're going to have to come up with a way to make sure that we don't have the workers' comp system, which is already too expensive. Everyone agrees to that. We don't want them paying for insurance and financial institution functions, do we?
No, we don't. Mr. Chairman, what this division will have to do is to determine where it is that they're spending their time,
yes,
and charge their time according to who's receiving the services. So when they're doing accounting and cashiering and data processing work for the insurance folks get that tab, and when they do it, we understand your concern about the dedicated funds.
Right. And we do want to reduce those workers' comp costs. Yes, we really do. Okay. President Jones.
Joe and me, of course, the bill had already passed the House regarding workers' comp. Is that going to make some great changes as far as FTEs return and so on in that position? Well, that probably wouldn't have any effect on this part of it anyway.
I really can't answer that.
Well, of course, if they're going to accomplish by that bill what everybody's asked them to do, they've got to reach and cut someplace. And whether it will affect this bringing the workers' comp over into this division or not, I don't know, but it's a pretty fair question that I'd kind of like to have answered.
Mr. Chairman, Jerry Brown, the Director of Workers' Compensation Department, is here, and he might be able to answer.
Hello, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Brown, Director of the Workers' Compensation Department. In answer to Representative Jones's question, the House Bill 2103 that passed the House eliminates what we call the evaluation division, or the major part of the evaluation division, as of January 1, 1988. That has a savings in the department budget of about $1.5 or $1.3 million a year. The biannual budget of the evaluation division, I believe, is $2.7 million, and it's eliminated, as I indicated, on January 1. There is a little phase out. We've priced that, we've fiscal impact that out, so it does affect the department. The other point I might make, I know you all have an interest in workers' comp. You all have an interest in workers' comp cost. I have heard so much about workers' compensation costs and the department's part in that. I want you to know that you can eliminate the department and you will save 3% on workers' compensation costs. If you want to save on workers' compensation costs, you've got to deal with the workers' compensation system, not the workers' compensation department. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. We weren't going to do any terrible damage, I don't think. We just wanted to make sure there wasn't any cross-subsidization with those dedicated fees, and we also don't want to spend more than we have to.
I'm sure the employers are just as concerned as you are that the premium assessment is not used to support other activities, and we put together this budget to in an attempt to try to assure that. We do have a situation here where and there were questions asked about efficiencies. What we've done is taken the administrative support division of the existing workers' compensation department and added the insurance division and financial institution division for that structure to support. So there is an efficiency there, a savings there, when that happens. We've also done that with the existing workers' compensation personnel department. Personnel divisions. Those two support units, now have more program and more agency to support, and there are no increased staff for those people in doing that. So that's where the efficiencies are.
So there's some savings there.
Yes.
Yeah. Then, in further response to Representative Jones' question there does need to be an investment by the state in performance review of, we'll say, physicians, chiropractors, people like that, that's provided for in the House bill, and that costs some money but produces some savings, right?
Yes, that's.
So you have to spend a little to make some larger savings. Is it? What do you think about having the medical director up at the department head level away from the division?
No, I support that, Mr. Chairman. The structure of this bill puts the policy responsibility for workers' compensation programs, along with insurance and regulation of banks and other related institutions, in the director's office of this new department. And as the policymaker and the policy decider, I think it's perfectly appropriate that the medical director be associated with that office.
Are banks going to get into medicine now, too?
The director of the Department of Insurance and Finance?
Sorry.
Yes.
Makes sense. There's hanging out. A little clinic in the back. Get you by your insurance. Great. Okay.
He's a Visa card in the surgery center.
Sorry. Go ahead.
We've talked about financial institutions and division budget yesterday pretty much, and so maybe Mr. Miller would like to go into the insurance division's budget request, and that starts on page 6.
Yes, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is basically run through the various budget packages for you, and then, if you wish, discuss some of the pending legislation that we think may have an impact on the division, although I think I sense that the committee already has in mind how it wishes to proceed in regard to the legislative packages. But I'll start with the package 366, the restoration of the base budget. The assumption that's inherent in that package is that you must stay within that, that the division must stay within the current fee structure, and if that were the case, we would have to cut two positions out of our public service section. Basically, that's the section that answers complaints from the public about the conduct of insurers, including the settlement of claims and the cancellation of policies. This package restores those current positions and requests a corresponding fee increase. It also increases our 1985-87 authorized Attorney General's expense by approximately $41,000. Our revised expenditure estimate for the current biennium, revised as of June 1st, indicates that our total 1985-87 expenditure for Attorney General's fees will be approximately $115,000, so our projected AG's costs, if anything, may be conservative. And without this, we would have to severely reduce the complaint processing service to the public, and that is if the two base budget positions were not restored. And that's the purpose for asking for this package. And package 362 relates to public service staffing. This function we think is critical to the division in its effort to protect the public. The position included here is a compliance officer at a salary range 22. The supporting positions are crucial to the service that's offered to the public by our compliance division and our complaint processing. Again, this package relates to that compliance division and our ability to process and answer complaints on behalf of the insurance buying public. Since Commissioner Kulongoski took office, both the number of phone calls that the division receives relating to insurance and the number of formal complaints that are filed by citizens of the state have increased substantially. I don't have the exact figure, but I could get those for you. And they've remained substantially higher since approximately the first of the year.
Mr. Miller, is this package 362, the property casualty insurer rate and form filings, would that include potentially the possibility, as I understand the House bill that was sent over to the Senate, now in the Senate Labor Committee, that there may be an additional function added to the insurance division to review? It used to be the filing use rates on workers' compensation, and apparently they want the insurance commissioner to be able to review the rates as proposed by the workers' compensation carriers. Would that cover this, or would this be in addition and above what the potential fiscal impact of that would be?
No, this would not include pending legislation. This is something that we had asked for
prior to
the introduction of various legislative measures relating to the rate hearing process and the commissioner's authority in that process.
So these are all requests that were asked,
yes,
even prior to the reorganization?
That's correct, Senator.
So you're not going to need these?
We No, Senator, I think we, assuming there were no changes and we, assuming there was no new legislation and that we were to continue business as usual, when we came in with our budget package, we were asking for this position in addition to the positions that we had in the 1985-87 biennium, because we did have a heavy workload of rates and forms filings. And again, I think I have provided some backup information in the past, and I can get that again. And we felt in order to provide service to the public in a timely service and help fulfill the expectations about the commissioner's role in the rates and forms review process, we needed this additional person.
Okay, then 361 data processing. Surely that systems analyst, it wouldn't be a permanent position, would it?
Yes, we had contemplated a permanent position for a systems analyst. I believe we might have skipped over 363, package 363, Mr. Chairman.
That was one that the e-board approved and you
right.
wanted to continue
mm-hmm.
it.
Okay, right. We'll go on. Then, yes, on the data processing system upgrade, we had asked for...
Well, has that been reviewed by Information Systems Division of Exec?
It was reviewed in the governor's review process, and I assume reviewed by Exec Department at that time. It was also reviewed by the Commerce Division data processing people at the time that we submitted the budget.
The answer is no.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was reviewed as it was originally requested, but now with the reorganization and insurance division going to the workers and going to the new Department of Insurance and Finance,
right.
which will have available to it some of the resources that currently worker compensation folks have.
We better have a look taken at
we
it
may
by information
want to look
systems.
At it again.
Let's, yeah, that
may,
makes some sense.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to we before we got into the reorganization process, maybe I should describe the system that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. But no. Before we got into the reorganization process, we intended to get off the exec department mainframe for our agents' licensing and have our own freestanding system.
Yeah.
When we found out that the reorganization was going to take place, we described to the people at the Workers' Compensation Division the approximate number of transactions, the kinds of things that we wanted to accomplish, mm-hmm. and the equipment that we had requested to do that. They felt that was reasonable. And even if we are combined, that it would be reasonable for us to have our own freestanding data processing system. And if we have a systems analyst, to put that analyst in the centralized workers' comp data processing section and dedicate that person to our needs.
Yeah, I don't think we're questioning the need to upgrade the data. We just want an outside look at it and a review of it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's clearly what you need. This would be going to like a VS 65, probably, right?
That's exactly right. It
so
is
it's
a VS.
It's a pretty good upgrade. Right now, we don't know to what extent workers' comp can absorb some of their load. I mean, Bob has told you they've had some informal conversations, but frankly, I think we'd all probably feel a bit more comfortable, including the department, if we had Jerry Schmitz and someone like him come in and look at the load that's now on the workers' comp system and look at what the insurance folks have to do and see to what extent workers' comp can accommodate them without buying into the new system. I don't think we ought to preclude that notion, but certainly it ought to be proven or supported before you go ahead.
Probably we'd unschedule it subject to that review.
Yeah.
And I think we might make the systems analyst limited duration too, but I don't.
I think you have a real good point there, because we'd want to look at the systems development staff in workers' comp right now
yeah.
to see to what extent we could use that staff to help the insurance division before we put on full-time systems.
if I may, Mr. Chairman, just to add one thing. We have what we think is an adequate software package, but we have incorporated in here some savings predicated on the idea that we will have our own system up and running and be off exact mainframe within a certain period of time. So if it's not timely and we can't do that, then the projected savings won't be realized.
And you'd have to eat it.
There shouldn't be, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, there shouldn't be any problem with that, though, because JLCDP will likely meet in August at the first emergency board to hear a number of requests. So I would think how timely it is depends on these folks, not on you, because you'll be ready to hear their request.
Okay. And you were just saying it was in the last 10 minutes of the meeting they were looking at the savings. It says here.
It'd be $48,000, I think, of savings, Mr. Chairman, over a biennium. So if action were taken in the first or second month of the biennium.
It says for 10 months of savings, is what it said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we're in the time frame.
Thank you.
Okay.
Joan is going to describe to you then packages 106 and 206.
The next two decision packages are somewhat confusing. They talk about the old packages that were in the budget requesting the prime replacement and other charges that you needed to pay, that this division would need to pay to Department of Commerce, Central Administrative Services. These costs will no longer be required. And so we've listed the decision packages, but they...
I just do this with my pencil. Right?
Right. The only precaution, and Mr. Weeks and I have talked about this, is I've previously taken out ASSD service charges. So in Mr. Weeks' calculations, he's going to be careful so that we don't take out that same dollar twice, but we don't need those decision packages.
Got it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
In regard to the new legislation, I think that the material here is basically self-explanatory. Mr. Weeks and I have discussed some of this, and I have provided some fiscal impact statements relating to the various bills. I don't know if any more explanation is desired, necessary, or not.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Mr. Miller a question?
Yeah.
Is risk retention, is that what we know as Senate Bill 1031?
That's correct, Mr. Weeks. That is SB 1031. I think we were just recently introduced. We didn't have a bill number.
Yeah. And we talked about 323. 2445, I don't know where it is.
I checked on that this week, Mr. Chairman. It's still in committee. It doesn't, quite frankly, look like it's going to pass.
Bill. Still in a House committee at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
There are some others out there that may pass that haven't been described here that we know have additional costs for the commissioner. HB 2900 is one that comes to mind. It has a payroll audit function for the commissioner.
Well, it just reinforces the informal decision to set this aside to e-board action. So it's just no way of predicting. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there's one package that we haven't discussed yet, and it's not listed in this book, although it's in the original governor's printed budget, and it's not your favorite topic. It's package 365, which requests the reclassification of three positions with no funding. And I wanted to let you know that that is part of this request, although it's not listed in this book because there's no dollar that we're not asking for funding for it. And it's a secretary to a word processor and two clerical assistants to clerk specialists.
And with no money.
With no money.
Representative Jones.
There will be the authority to do this in the bill itself. Are you saying you're going to do it anyway?
presented, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of the process is if the Ways and Means Committee approves the reclass, then it becomes part of the budget.
And the court has that in the, we haven't seen that in writing.
No, it's not. What you've done in the past is to, when the governor has recommended reclassifications without funding, you've instructed the agency that if they go ahead, in fact, you really haven't said go ahead and do it. You've said if you go ahead and reclass positions, we want you to identify the source of funding.
Well,
maybe you've de facto agreed to do it, but the point is, if it comes out of S&S, you want to know about it for next biennium.
Yeah, but then they have the authority to do that.
They tend to do it. Yeah.
They do it all the time.
They do it all the time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they have the authority to reclass if they can find permanent funding at any point.
Even poor little starving tiny agencies will get a reclass, and by golly, they'll find a way to fund that.
Except, though, the bad thing about that is they reclass without funding, and then it's in the next year's budget without any action taken on it of any kind, and then the next
That's exactly right.
But, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's precisely, though, why you've been asking them to identify the positions, the amount of the reclass, and the source of funding for the reclass, so that 2 years from now you can go back and say, you get the reclass of the PIC system, the payroll system, but it's going to come out somewhere else, so that if there isn't a net gain from buying to buying and rolling forward.
Then there's that bill that the Ways and Means Committee introduced, said that they can't go off and do reclasses to the board or to Ways and Means.
So that's a bill.
It's a good bill. Higher Ed, I think, needs it more than anyone.
I'm sure they do.
Chairman, we had another item.
And that was the one that prevents it from being used or sold or?
Yes, Senate Bill 551 is basically prohibits the sale of TBT paints for boats less than 25 meters in length. And for boats over 25 meters in length, the anti-fouling paint can be used, but it's got to have a special formulation with low leaching rates, so that the amount of paint that's actually leached off the boat in order to control the anti-fouling organisms leaches off at a rate that would be comparable to its degradation in the environment.
So that's what the informational program would be conducting, and that would be through primarily the fisheries, what association or licensures, or how would you mail out? How do you know who these? It's estimated you're going to have to mail out $3,000 worth of cost to mail out to these people. How do you know who they are and where they're at? Are they all registered?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon. These are people that have their boats registered with the Marine Board, so it's a matter of going into our file, doing a computer sort, selecting those over 20 feet in length, and mailing a notice to those individuals. They're people with a registered boat.
Would this, Mr. Chairman, would this include other boats coming into Oregon that are not necessarily registered in Oregon as well? For instance, if a commercial fishing boat, say like in California, docked at Brookings, unloaded their catch in Brookings, but they're primarily based in California. How would they get notice of this?
We wouldn't be able to provide them notice through the mailing. The bill also directs us to make the brochure available to port district offices and marine supply places on the coast. So that's one possible source. Also, I think within the marine industry itself, there's been quite a bit of publicity. I think commercial fishermen and people that are really tuned in to the marine industry are aware of the TBT issue this year. It's been raised in California. In fact,
right.
California legislature is dealing with similar efforts, as is Washington State.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 554? If not, then I'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Move it out, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Stinson may be first. Does this mean they have to come to the emergency board then for a limitation?
Mr. Chairman, this would require that if they find that their approved budget, which has already passed both houses, is insufficient to handle this as well as anything else that may get legislated or come to their attention, that they would have to come to the emergency board for an increase in the expenditure limitation.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. Representative
Johnson. That is possible to just put the limitation in there. You have to spend it for the venture if you want to come back.
Mr. Chairman, a section could be added here if that's your pleasure. I'm aware of, I don't believe any of the other bills here before you today carry a requirement, an absolute requirement for expenditure limitation. This is the only one I'm aware of. There are several other pieces of legislation, one of which we were discussing earlier, yes, that may in fact carry limitation with it. And the question is would those issues likewise have to carry independent expenditure authority with the measure, amending the budget within each measure, or would you simply have the agency return to the emergency board with a plan and a program for expenditure at some later point in time? It's
whatever.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
Well, I think, quite frankly, it'd be hard to set a limitation on it today and then have the postage increase or have something else increase, and then it'd still have to come back to the e-board and get authorization to raise the limitation at that point. And it'd probably be better to have them just come back to the emergency board at the appropriate time to have all their costs in hand, and the emergency board can approve their increase.
Or they might be able to find some funds. Except he said he wouldn't. How often do you come to the emergency board normally?
Infrequently.
Very infrequently.
I do expect that we will be to the emergency board at least one time during the interim as a result of federal funds.
Okay. Why don't we just handle it in the e-board? So, Senator Hennen moves and gross Senate Bill 554 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Objections? Hearing none. Carries. Maybe Representative Hanneman would like to carry it on the full committee and on the House floor and on the Senate floor. Senator Bradbury is the chief sponsor. So,
who are you going to give it to on the House floor?
Oh, Hanneman. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we'll do some other bill. We're in Senate. No, there's another Senate bill. We got the Senate bill book out. Or did you have a different recommendation?
It's going to be easy. Here we go.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 38.
Senate Bill 38 was requested by the Marine Board in order to protect the public using the waters of the state. As amended by the Senate Transportation Committee, it does two things. First, it gives the board authority to regulate the installation and use of water ski courses, ski jumps, and similar special use devices placed on the waters of the state. Presently, there's no public interest review of these courses, and we've run into a number of cases where there are problems from people placing them in inappropriate locations, resulting in landowner conflicts and conflicts with other users. We would intend to initiate through a permit process a very limited public interest review to include at the minimum the county sheriff who does marine patrol, local landowners or managing agencies, and others with an interest in that course or devices. We do not intend to apply this to casual one-day affairs by individual persons. It would apply to organized events and seasonal or semi-permanent courses. In the original bill, we did ask for a permit fee. We've reconsidered the need for that fee and would ask that it be deleted or, at the committee's pleasure, capped at $25 as a discretionary fee that we would not have to charge as a permissive fee. The revenue and fiscal impact is truly negligible. If deleted, it could be done by inserting a period after the word permit on line 20 of page 2 and deleting the rest of that sentence. The second part of the bill in Section 3 gives the board discretionary authority to remove fallen trees, logs, debris, and other debris that constitutes a hazard to boating safety. Presently, there's no agency of the state or federal government charged with the removal of such items when they pose a direct and immediate hazard to floaters. This is primarily a river issue and deals with drift boats and other users. Although the primary beneficiaries of our involvement in that type of activity are non-motorized users who are not currently part of the boating program in terms of fees, we believe there is an obligation to protect lives regardless of who pays the bill, and would hope that later consideration be given to House Bill 2769, which would provide a way for these users to support the boating programs which benefit them in activities such as this, the removal of hazards on rivers. We have in the past become involved in this type of activity on the Siletz River, the San Am River system, and some other places, but really it's without clear statutory authority to do so. I want to note that the removal of those fallen trees and debris will be limited to the minimum needed to secure safe passage. I don't want anyone to think that we're going to go into wholesale clearing projects of rivers, because we do recognize that the debris, the rocks, and other things are an important form of habitat. And so it's only going to be for the removal to secure safe passage for the public. And normally these activities are done in close concert with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're usually very much aware of these hazards and the need to remove them. We do not need a budget modification to accommodate these provisions of the bill, and I would request your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You hinted at House Bill 2769. Do you need that in order to provide the...
No. I was simply indicating that most of the beneficiaries from these debris removing activities are non-motorized boaters, and even though they don't support the programs financially, that's not an impediment to us going ahead, because there is an overriding need for public safety and a need to act. It's quite a scary situation when a tree falls bank to bank on some of these popular float streams. Steelhead fishermen and other people continue to go down despite the hazard, and trees and things like that, the Fallen River, do constitute a very serious public safety hazard. So we feel there's a need to move in and take care of those.
Okay. Does anyone want to testify on Senate Bill 38? Okay. Close the public hearing, open work session on Senate Bill 38. What are they doing with the building? Does anyone know? We'll find out before we get back into the legislative administration budget. Just cut the heck out of it. Okay.
You want to move it?
Sure. Well, first, let's delete.
So yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to say, are we going to deal with these amendments?
Yeah.
What he's proposing is that we delete the fee, or...
Yeah, just sort of bracket it out on page 2, line 20, after permit, putting a period, and deleting everything else on that line and on line 21. Senator Hannon made that motion, and is there objection? It carries. And then Representative Jones moves and goes Senate Bill 38 as further amended by the subcommittee to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Objections? Hearing none. Okay.
Carriers on this
one. Oh boy. Who wants to carry this? Senator Hannon. And then on the House floor, Representative Jones.
I think they probably give me all the time today, so that I don't have to worry about the rest of the session.
I'd appreciate it. You carry them so well. You do. And you modulate your voice just right about at the noise level in the house, and it works real well.
Yeah, you can't hear me at all. That's what the most of them.
Okay, so now where do we go?
2038.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2038.
Introduced by the board. The purpose of it is really quite simple. It raises the fee for the outfitter guide registration from $25 to $50. The reason for that is to make the program self-sufficient financially. Presently, it does not pay its own way. 1983, when Chapter 704 was created, which requires the registration of guides and outfitters, really there was no way of knowing the cost, and the fee at that time, which was set at $25, was indeed quite arbitrary. With several years' experience, we now know that the program is not self-sufficient as it was intended to be. We estimate the per-registration cost somewhere over just over $40. At the end of last year, we had about 585, I think there's about 550 guides presently registered. The deficit balance for the program is being paid by Oregon's registered boat owners, a situation we felt be rectified. We don't feel that the registered boat owner should subsidize this program to any extent. The program with the request for a fee of from $25 to $50, the program will pay its own way, and that really only assumes the cost of administration. There's no funding in this program for law enforcement, and I want that to be clear that with that funding level, we're not able to contract with the state police or county sheriffs for any major enforcement of the guide program. I think, as you can see, by comparison to other western states, the fee in Oregon is the lowest of the western states for registration. Most other states range upwards to $300 in Colorado. We feel it's only fair that the program pay its own way and would encourage your support of the bill. I would note that the State and Federal Affairs Committee has requested an interim study of the entire guide and outfitter registration program from the speaker. We're very supportive of that. There are a number of other issues other than the fee that should be addressed. These were raised at the State and Federal Affairs Committee. The committee didn't have the time in the session to deal with all of them. Briefly, they range from liability insurance requirements to the question of enforcement. There's a whole host of issues, and rather than amending this bill substantially, they passed it out intact and requested that an interim study be put together to look at that program.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir, Hammond.
Does it appear that the initial cost when the person applies to become a registered guide or outfitter that the initial cost is greater because you have to investigate to see if they're bonded or insured or whatever than if it was just a person sending in a renewal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hanna, there really is no savings in the renewal process. We still have to determine that they have their insurance, their first aid, and all the information. There may be some minor time savings in that we don't have to ask them to repeat some of the information, but in terms of processing, it's just about the same. The program is being handled with less than a full-time person. We have a person working 3 days a week, so we're not even providing the guides with 5 day a week service on this. If they call on a Thursday or Friday, we'll take their number and call them back on Monday.
Does increasing this the $25 to $50, will that cover your deficit of the $16,000 plus give you a little bit of cash carry forward into the next payment?
Yes. The present cost, as best we can determine it for administration is just over $40 per registration. So we'd be a few dollars to the good if the fee were increased to 50. We haven't requested any increase in staffing to in association with the bill. The S&S portion of it, that is really pretty modest. Most of this is just personnel time.
Did the outfitters and guides come before the substantive committee and support this?
The outfitters and guides, the Oregon Guides and Packers and other groups, did appear before the committee with a host of amendments. They're initially, they wanted more enforcement for the program. It's a major concern of theirs that there's not enough field enforcement for the guide program. And they had amendments suggesting that 50% of the revenue we collect be used for enforcement. Well, that put us back to $25 for administration, and it would only generate a very small amount of funding for enforcement, nothing more than a token effort. We calculated that to get any real field enforcement would cost, the fee would have to go up in the order of about $200 per year in order to get some real field enforcement.
And the committee wasn't willing to go that high?
The committee was not willing to address that issue along with the others. They simply passed it out as is. I think that is still an issue, one that we would hope the interim committee would address, because there is an expectation, I think, reasonably, and it's a reasonable expectation, that if you're going to pay $25 or $50 or whatever, and there's someone else out there guiding that isn't registered, that's a pirate, that somebody ought to go get them. And I think that's a very real.
Representative Jones.
That's what I was going to ask you, if that was the problem with people guiding without a license at all. So that happens in other businesses.
Yeah, like pawnbrokers.
But they, you know, I wanted to, we tried to make it clear to the guides that even with this fee increase, there isn't going to be a new enforcement presence.
And do they understand that?
I think they understand that.
And do they support the increase to $50?
Reluctantly.
Are they here? Okay. Reluctantly.
I don't think anybody likes to pay more for any.
Well, especially when they don't get what they want, which is enforcement.
Exactly. They don't feel they're getting anything for their money now. They'll be getting, in a sense, more of the same, but paying more. We would support an increased fee for enforcement. We did before that committee, but given what the committee did with it and the request for an interim study, I don't feel that it's appropriate today to ask for more than we were going for in the original fee.
We'd probably have a little problem with that on the floor if we did that. Okay, anybody else want to testify on this bill? And then we'll do, we'll go into a work session, close in the public hearing on House Bill 2038. Mr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the only other thing that hadn't been mentioned is you'll note that the words in the law read registration. And that, I think, is one of the issues that is yet to be resolved, is whether we register or whether we license. And licensing assumes some determination of competency beyond simply presenting yourself as available for the service, possessing a first aid card, and having the necessary liability insurance. And some of these other states that have these higher fees do, in fact, license. A number of those other states do, in fact, have discriminatory fees against out-of-state guides who want to guide in their terrain. I think the most recent to enter that field was the state of Washington.
Yes.
So there's a whole host of issues surrounding this thing on the outside, and it was that whole can of worms that apparently the committee decided was not a timely matter to enter into at this moment, but would rather take a full interim study. So I think what has been presented to you is fairly one that continuation of this registration process that is a, I think, accepted by everybody as being a very minimal protection to the public who use these services, requires more money than is currently being paid to do it, and it's being subsidized by the voters, and it takes money away from other projects and facilities and programs of the voters in order to carry this out, and this represents the fair allocation of cost to those individuals getting this registration service.
Got it. So, the idea then, you know, the interim study would be to look at a licensing program, possibly.
I think the most fundamental question that committee will have to ask themselves is, should the state of Oregon register or license the guides? I mean, should the program continue? This was to be the subject of a sunset review, but it, as a part of a separate Senate bill, that sunset was taken off the program. We feel that fundamental question does need exploring, whether the public interest is really served by a registration. I think first aid card and liability insurance certainly doesn't make one a guide, and yet that's all that we currently require. It creates a misconception on the part of the public. The public thinks, gee, this guy's registered with the state of Oregon, he must be all right. In fact, anyone with a first aid card and proof of insurance can hang out that sign.
Was there any House member of that committee who was a proponent of this bill?
No.
What are you going to do with this, Representative Jones?
Voter.
You're not a voter. I'm not a voter. I mean, it makes sense, a reasonable bill. I'm just thinking of the House floor. No, it's a House bill. There's no other committee. We could send it to Sunset Review.
Well, send it to Cincha Bill to abolish that.
Maybe we can post it up and Senator Hammond can carry it. And then we can say, well, Senator Hammond carried it in the bill committee. We don't know too much about it.
Well, I'll take it.
He will take it, by golly. Okay, well, so Senator Hannon moves House Bill 2038 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hannon.
One other question. Did this come down from the House Transportation Committee?
No, it came from state federal affairs.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would urge you to find somebody from that committee in the House to assign it to and carry it in the House.
That's exactly what I think is a very good suggestion. Well, so. That's exactly what he's going to get to do.
Yeah.
It's a privilege of the chairmanship. Okay, so objection to Senator Hannon's motion, hearing carries. Senator Hannon will carry it to the full committee, and Representative Lonnie Roberts will carry it on the House floor.
I believe he was very supportive of the idea of the making
the fair allocation.
It's a fair allocation.
That's correct. I'm sure he'll do well. Okay, then we have, public hearing on House Bill 2037. A nice little testimony written up for each one of us in the request. Maybe we didn't cut their budget in time.
That was for this biennium that they were over budget.
Because
I had their budget last time, and I allowed too much. Joan Wibbins had it this time, and I think for next biennium she trimmed them down a little further.
That's good.
House Bill 2037 does several things with Chapter 488, the voting chapter. For the most part, these are minor technical changes, although it does add one new provision dealing with penalty for late title transfer. The first five sections of the bill amend existing provisions dealing with the titling and registration of floating homes and boathouses. We've had this program since 1977 and have about 1,300 floating homes or boathouses titled with the board. About 200 are titled and registered each year. The present program is both a title and a registration program. The only real reason for this law is to provide owners with a title as means of proof of ownership so that they can secure a loan on that title, use that title for security interest purposes. When the bill was originally prepared, our main interest was in revising the fee schedule for that to more accurately cover cost. Again, it's similar to the last bill. At $2 per title and $6 per registration, which are the current fees, that program wasn't supporting itself. Again, the boat owners were really subsidizing, in a sense, the registration of floating homes and boathouses, which really aren't directly tied to boating. The bill was amended by House Transportation to reflect a titling-only program with a new fee of $20 for title or duplicate title. That title, combined with the plate which we currently issue for identification, is sufficient for ownership purposes. And so we agreed with the deletion of the registration requirement as simply a redundant, mm-hmm. non-necessary function. Based on our best estimates, the actual cost to the agency for one of these titles is just under $20. The amended version of sections 1 through 5 simplifies the requirement, eliminates an unnecessary registration, and does make the program self-sufficient. In section 6, the bill modifies our statute to require notification of title transfer within 30 days. The current language provides notice within only a reasonable time, which is simply too vague. Section 7 provides the board rulemaking authority to establish a penalty for late title transfers. This is intended to follow Motor Vehicle Division's change last session, providing for a penalty for late transfer. Failure to transfer boat titles promptly is one of the primary causes of contested case situations, with two or more parties claiming ownership of the same boat. And the cost to the state in sorting out those types of claims is quite expensive. Like the DMV, we would propose rules establishing a late fee of $25 for titles transferred after 30 but less than 60 days, and then $50 for those titles transferred after 60 days. We would make every effort to make the public aware of this change. In Section 8, the bill changes the penalty for making false statements from a boating infraction to a Class A misdemeanor. We feel that brings that penalty into line with the seriousness of the offense and is consistent with other false statement offenses. That section also adds ORS 488-880 to the penalty section. In 1985, as a result of a Senate bill that was passed giving the board authority to regulate boating to protect traditional uses and prevent conflicts, that section 488-880 was added. However, it was not incorporated into our penalty section. We don't feel rules adopted under that would be enforceable, and the bill corrects that oversight. Section 9 amends the penalty for knowingly buying or selling boats with altered numbers, again from boating infraction to a misdemeanor. We feel the current penalty is outdated. Section 10 deletes two obsolete definitions in our definitions part 488.011. Subsections 3 and 4 have no usefulness since the program it refers to was sunsetted in 1981. That's just a housekeeping matter. The bill does have a number of different elements. There's no need to change our budget limitation to accommodate the bill. Although it has a minor impact on revenues associated with the floating home and floating home fees and title fees, we don't need a change in limitation, and would encourage your support of the bill.
What are you going to do with the 3 cents profit on each title?
Invest it.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Henry.
Perhaps he should be in charge of the banking division rather than the Marine Board, yeah. Since they have a deficit.
We could add that to that department.
Consolidated relates.
Anybody else want to tell?